Hi there, this is Dan Delta Collins. You're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs is broadcast live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on twitch.tv/wanderingdms and also youtube.com/wanderingdms. We hope you enjoy the show.
Hi everyone, welcome to Wandering DMs. I'm Paul.
And I'm Dan, and today on Wandering DMs we have D&D historian Shannon Appleklein, who has a new four-volume set covering every single official D&D product from the early days, including original D&D, basic D&D, advanced D&D first edition. There's even some stuff I've never heard of before. All that and more today on Wandering DMs.
Before we get into the discussion today, I'll remind everyone, as always, at the end of the show, we will be hosting our after-party chat. That is a live video chat that Dan and I host on our Discord server, and you can join in. Just join our Patreon at any tier. Visit patreon.com/wanderingdms, and you'll get an invite to our Discord server. Get your account all set up before the end of the show, and maybe 10 to 15 minutes after the end of the show, we will be there to talk to you all live.
We love that part. We'll see everybody there. So Shan, thank you so much. For viewers' sake, Paul and I are on the East Coast of the US and Shan is based in Hawaii. So, Mr. Appleklein did have to get up at 6 a.m. this morning in order to join our show. Shan, thank you so much for queuing up for that.
No problem. Happy to be here. It's the price I have to pay sometimes for living out here in Hawaii.
We appreciate your adventurous spirit, of course. So if I look at the 10 second elevator pitch for your product, your upcoming project Origins D&D, what it says is this massive 4-volume set covers the history behind each and every product released by TSR for OD&D, AD&D first edition, and basic D&D, and it the four books add up to over 1,400 pages of material. So my first question is, what compelled you to take on this colossal project in the first place?
It was fortunately a request from someone. DriveThruRPG said, hey, we are putting the PDFs back online for all of the classic D&D projects. This was 2014, started 2015. And they'd been unavailable for several years because Wizards Coast was afraid of piracy. Like, they could stop piracy by not having their products online themselves. And DriveThruRPG really wanted to make a big deal of it. They wanted to be a kind of continuing party for as many years as they could put out new products. And they said, we want to put these products out every single week, and we'd like to have a description history, something like that for each of them. Would you like to do some of these? And so that naturally accumulated over the course of what would turn out to be almost 5 years. And by putting together somewhere between 2 and 4 histories most weeks, added together for what was 250 weeks or so, and you eventually get some content.
Wow. Wow. I'm so glad they asked. And I've always been impressed when I do run into those projects on DriveThruRPG. I'm just really surprised, frankly, by the very high quality of the attached articles, because the first time I saw one, I assumed it would be some kind of promo fluff text that and it's like a really detailed, smart, sharp, insightful commentary on every single one of those that always has stuff that I didn't know about. And sometimes I'm not entirely sure how you found out. So I've always been really impressed by that stuff that you have on DriveThruRPG for those.
Thank you. I've probably gotten enough comments, as many comments on the original product histories as I have on my Designers and Dragons Company histories that I wrote. So good to have them finally coming out in books in a much updated, expanded, revised form. Yeah, I think one of the reasons that they came out so full is because DriveThruRPGs was totally respectful of my IP creative rights as the creator of them. And so we had to negotiate a little bit, but they let me hold on to rights for all of them. And so when I was writing for them, I was aware I wasn't just writing this for, I got paid $15 for each of those ones I put online, which obviously a lot more work went into each. I was like, hey, I'm creating a catalog, and maybe someday I will put these into a book. And that was, like I said, starting in 2015, I was writing them. And now, 10 years later, they are coming out in books.
That's fantastic. One thing I really like, I saw that you said recently, you said, well, it takes a village to publish something too. So you have a number of our acquaintances, frankly, that we've had on the show before that pitched in some kind of editorial or review type capacity. And I know that Tom from Evil Hat Productions that's publishing it has been enormously helpful, like, frankly, for helping to set up this show here today. Who else have you had do review type tasks before this gets out?
Well, even before it went to Evil Hat, I passed it around to friends, acquaintances on the internet who had some familiarity with these times. I'd often ask the original authors, hey, there wasn't a lot about this, or hey, I had a question about this, as much as I can. I mean, there's unfortunately some people that I talk to who are no longer with us, like Janelle Jacques gave me commentary and thoughts on a lot of her original work, which you can find in some of the later parts of this. At Evil Hat, you know, we had Sean Nittner, who does the project management. We had Chris Hanrahan, who I think has been my biggest fan over there, and there's their business manager. We have Chris Viana, who did a gorgeous layout. I was just stunned when I saw the full color layout of this book for the first time, because I wasn't expecting it. Karen Twelves, who did the editing, yet is a named person to do the proofreading. Fred Hicks, who, you know, does a lot of the overall oversight. It does take a village. Most of the other people don't get the same recognition, because as you can see, there's my name really big on the cover, but at least on the interior, we have everyone featured on the cover page in all the same font.
Fantastic. That's awesome. So what? So tell us what the four volumes. How do you have that? How do you have that organized?
Yeah. So my roughest organization is: hey, I want this in chronological order, and beyond that, I needed organization of principles. So you're not just reading, you know, this endless stream of products. And so there's 12, 13, 14 chapters in each book, and they're roughly organized by topic category. And so, like, the first two chapters, there's all the original rule books for OD&D, that's chapter one. And then there's all of the accessories that were done for OD&D, which get a little sloppy what game they were for. You know, were they OD&D, basic D&D, AD&D, because they were all so overlapping in the era that no one really, I think, cared about them being different games, particularly in the 70s. But also, there's a big division in the books in that I talk everything about OD&D, that's the first two chapters, and then I talk everything about AD&D First Edition, that's chapter 3 in book 1 through the end of book 2, and then I step back and I talk about basic D&D. And so basic D&D starts in book 3 with the J. Eric Holmes version, goes on to BX, BCMI, the Gazetteers, and eventually the Mistara products for AD&D 2E that were the last gasp of what basic D&D used to be.
Yeah, following that trail, I think is I remember being surprised when I was looking at your outline and going from OD&D to AD&D and went, oh no, he skipped Holmes, and then realizing, oh no, that comes in book 3. But of course, you have this kind of forking path, and I think that's something that confuses people to this day, right? I think there's a lot of folks who aren't as steeped in the history become surprised that there was kind of two product lines running in parallel during the early 80s.
Yeah, I mean, my first book was the BX version of Basic D&D. My dad got it for it, ran me my first adventure through it. And, you know, not long after that, I went to Toys R Us, and I picked up the hardcover book starting with the Player's Handbook Monster Manual, as probably a lot of us did in that era. And you use them together. I mean, you didn't really see the difference in them. Basic D&D, it was levels 1 to 3. You know, Advanced D&D, it went from 1 to however high, but a lot of the level charts started topping out at 14, 15, something like that. And, you know, as unsophisticated hated gamers, as at least I was in the era, you didn't really understand that, hey, this one had races as classes and this just had classes. You just figured they were different things and you could use either of them. I had a much treasured possession, which is actually one of the few things from the era still on my shelf, which is the Greyhawk supplement for OD&D, which I managed to pick up, you know, jammed onto the shelves of a hobby store, not even a game store, a hobby store. And we used that too if there was anything good in it. Snakes bubbling out of it. Yes, I better put that in a dungeon. It was one of the tricks traps that was listed in it.
I mean, your experience exactly mirrors my own of starting on BX, going to, for me, it was Playworld was the name of the my local toy store, and picking up some of the Gold Spine AD&D reprints at that point. And no idea that they were different games. And I also distinctly remember owning BX as well as the Player's Handbook, but not the Dungeon Master's Guide. And definitely feeling like something's missing, right? Like there were some parts that just seemed mysterious and strange. So it's fascinating now older gamers to look back and go, oh, I see what they were doing, but I'm not sure why.
And the funny thing about that was you were missing the rules, because back in first edition, the Dungeon Master Guide was where all the rules were. Player's Handbook, you only had the character creation, and you didn't even have how to roll the dice in the character creation. That was in the Dungeon Master Guide.
Yep. Yeah. Very confusing.
Yeah. All the hit rolls, all the saving throws were in the Dungeon Master's Guide. So yeah, how do I run a fifth level fighter? If you just have basic and you have the Player's Handbook and the Monster Manual, you still don't know how to roll an attack roll at that point. for somebody off third level. That's really funny. And I'll say, because I've struggled in the past on my blog regularly with what order to cover those things in. Should I go original D&D, basic, advanced, which like I just linguistically sounds like it should make sense, and then realize that original D&D, AD&D are much more closely connected at the hip than the basic line. And I guess I've seen... just in the last couple of years, I've seen more than one statement, I think including Frank Mentzer, that the intent with up through AD&D was that everything that happened in the campaigns, like the Greyhawk campaign for OD&D, should be consistent with the AD&D rules going forward. They literally explicitly considered it to be one single unitary game being evolved. So I've certainly struggled with that same, well, then how do I present the sequence when there's this unexpected connection between advanced and the first game? So I feel like you're going to surprise somebody one way, no matter how you lay that out.
Yeah. And my original design for the book, Holmes D&D, was the third chapter of the original book. You know, it had Holmes D&D, the character sheet they put out, In Search of the Unknown, and The Keep on the Borderlands. That's basically the Holmes D&D pack. And I eventually moved it over, in part just because it balanced the books better, but in part also because I felt like that fit better with BX and what went forward. Holmes D&D was really, really close to the OD&D rules, though. He wasn't trying to change them when he put it together. He was just trying to clarify them.
Totally, totally. And I would say that that's what I started with. So I started just a couple years before you guys. I did have the Holmes basic D&D box. And so when I see your visual table of contents, and that's the first thing, I get a little little jolt of joy out of that first basic product. But as the three of us all know, yeah, it was very close to the raid. Holmes considered himself to be an editor of the existing rules, was what he proposed to Gygax. And Gygax, we know, took an editorial pass through it and, you know, edited some stuff to make it more compatible with what he was doing. I guess injected these comments about you really need to see all caps Advanced Dungeons & Dragons for the rest of it. And then it kind of shifted into this different branch when we moved on to future editions. Shannon, right before we started, you were mentioning that it's the basic line, and I've played, you know, one of my longest campaigns I was running with the Moldvay BX rules, so all three of us have played extensively with that. And you mentioned that some of the more interesting innovations or evolutions were coming in that basic line, the ones that didn't have Gygax's name on it. What kinds of things were novel or caught your attention when you were working on this project about that basic line in the 80s?
Yeah, I think it did have Gygax's name. The big change was it also had Dave Arneson's name. The only one I'd have to look up would be the Immortals for BCMI, which might have just been labeled Frank Mentzer, but he still had his name on that. The basic D&D line, shockingly, was the less loved line by the people internal at TSR. And I think because it was the less loved line, even though it was selling gangbusters, you know, the basic boxes were bringing people in the early 80s. Keep on the Borderlands is probably the most published module ever at the time. And way down the line, the Black Box was also one that sold extremely well. Despite all of that, people at TSR didn't love it. They felt that the AD&D line was the prestigious line. And so a lot of people didn't care what was going on there. And as a result, they were able to do more exciting things without someone saying, no, you know, what are you doing to our game? And I feel like that started out in 1981. As we said, the J. Eric Holmes version, it was just editorial. Well-needed editorial, but just editorial. But you get the BX, and you have Tom Moldvay and David Zeb Cook working on it. And kind of really kicking ideas back and forth with each other. Steve Marsh was doing a lot of the work on that, too. And they came out with the Expert Set. And the Expert Set has this, you know, wonderful system for exploring wilderness. It really got developed, of course, in the Isle of Dread. And before that, all you had in OD&D was, hey, go buy Wilderness Survival from Avalon Hill and use that as a map for wilderness travel, which I actually see some modern people in the OSR talking about doing that, and it sounds kind of fun, but it wasn't a standalone system. And so that's where I feel like the innovation really started. And then it really blew up just 2 years later. I always find it amazing that the BX version with the Aero Lotus covers that some of us remember so well just lasted 2 years. But 2 years later, Frank Mentzer comes out with BECMI, and suddenly you have the companion set, which would have been 1984, and he's asking, you know, what if we took those two or three pages of rules in OD&D about rulership and made this whole system of domains and made this whole, you know, nine-book adventure series all about ruling those domains and going to war. They had the War Machine rules. And then he came up with the Master, and the Master is a bit more of a motley and introduces some things like weapon proficiencies, a few new classes. Felt more to me often like, you know, retreading some AD&D things to basic D&D. But then a year after that, we're to 1986 by this point, he says, well, what if we had this Immortals set that, you know, almost throws D&D out the window and offers a whole new role system? And after that, then Frank Mentzer leaves along with Gary Gygax. Bruce Hurd comes in and he starts taking over pretty much because no one cared about basic D&D, and he was the acquisitions editor. And because of that, he pretty much got to set basic D&D because all of the products were being written by external people. And he says, what if we did this whole system of gazetteers where we describe the setting? And comes out at the start of 87, which now a lot of people may not realize that was actually before the Forgotten Realms, just a few months before, but these were clearly the, you know, ones that came out first. And they also include very extensive skill systems. They include lots of new character classes where he's constantly saying, hey, we can revisit the original classes. What if we had merchants in the game? You know, what if we had shamans? And so just constantly under both Mentzer and Hurd in particular, but also going back to Moldvay and Cook, they were able to just do exciting new things in there. They incorporated Blackmoor, one of the original settings that had never really been in there. They said, you know, we're going to have this other setting that's thousands of years in the past, and it'll work out okay. They had more science fantasy there than in the AD&D line. It was just constant excitement, and when when I look back at it and you just look at AD&D and basic D&D, there's so much that was innovative in being basic D&D.
That's a good point. And I remember from that. Now, I will point out, like with the start of the expert wilderness discussion, that we have actually played with the outdoor survival map in our original D&D games. And you may possibly recognize the background to our show is the outdoor survival map. So it's still very close to our heart. And I remember from that same era that you're talking about, mid to late 80s, that the basic line had these kind of alongside the gazetteers had these creature expansion, player character creature expansion books. And the names are going to somewhat escape me, but there was one for basically fairy peoples, and you could play centaurs and pixies and sylphs and stuff. And there was, I think, night howlers, where you could play like undead and werewolves. And then there was the top ballista, where you could play flying type. And they had a whole campaign of a flying city and stuff like that. And I remember personally being, as a teenager, being really excited of them being really bold about rolling out different types of player character races in a way that they were not willing to do in AD&D at the time.
Yeah, those were the Creature Crucible series. And they were definitely the next big expansion. They put those out after they finished up with the Gazetteers. Gazetteers ran 14 books. And I think the Creature Crucibles actually overlapped the end of them, but they also had little subsettings within Mystara too.
Yes, I see our friend Disparal, I'm going to put this on screen, is reminding us about the Hollow World setting that I was going to about to forget about, and that was the on the basic D&D line. Again, kind of a bold move, right? You don't see, like in Greyhawk, them coming out with like, oh, the world is hollow, and here's a whole different play style that you can do with that. So that was exciting.
Yeah, Bruce Hurd was amazing. You know, it felt like every 2 to 3 years he was like, how can I reinvent this and do something exciting and new? And Hollow World was kind of the third iteration of that after the Gazetteers, after the Creature Crucibles. He was like, how can I do more Gazetteers? Maybe some of a world inside the world. And by then, of course, he'd blocked out the whole square of the known world. And you know, they had a really different pulpy feel to them. And we had the Millennium Empire, which was kind of, you know, ancient instead of some of the more medieval settings. So I agree. Very neat. And another notable expansion. And after that, super if you nice. Want to continue on, they had the Poor Wizard's Almanacs on after that, which were, you know, what if we did these not quite mechanic free because they had NPC write-ups in them, but mostly mechanic free. And they were repetitious and they were still trying to figure out the formula, but still they were something people hadn't done. They were digest size too. How, you know, weird and surprising was that for that time period?
Totally. Totally. And you know what? And also the trail maps, right? The trail maps that put together all of the small scale maps and the gazetteers. When I saw that in the store, giant wall-sized map with really tiny, relatively small-scale stuff you could actually use in a game, I immediately snapped it up, and they never did anything like that for any of the AD&D settings.
Yeah, and I do believe that was Bruce Hurd's idea. The Known World ones came out slightly later in the series after Realms, Kryn. I'm not sure which came first, but that's where they originated with, and it was, of course, because they had those gorgeous maps already.
Yes, totally. They really were. Now, one thing that you've done, Shannon, that I adore on your website, designersanddragons.com, is you put together a number of visual timelines, and visual timelines or table of contents, if you want. And Paul, I have one of those set up. It's got a big. It's got some white space on the top right. Is the one I'm thinking of.
Yep.
So this is not the whole thing of the first of your two timelines. So just to give people, our viewers, a sense, this is like about half of the timeline that Shannon put together on his website about what the contents of the first two volumes are, the original and advanced volumes, basically. And it's clickable. You can click through all the different products to get a full-sized cover, which I adore. And I'll say that this is the kind of thing that a number of years ago, I wish I had. Like, there was a time, Shannon, I don't know how many years ago, there's like, I need to do this me in order to explain to other people who aren't aware of the early days and the split and the parallel lines that we were dealing with. And the fact that, you know, a lot of people we talk to think that basic D&D was the first one. And a lot of people, sometimes even authors and experts in D&D, aren't aware that there was a thing that came before basic D&D, actually. So I adore this. And I know that, I think I saw you say that laying things out on a timeline like this makes certain patterns pop out more self-evidently. And I'm wondering what kinds of patterns popped out to you when you laid things out on these timelines?
Yeah, so this one that you're showing here, it's OD&D, which you can see up at the top left, and it's AD&D, which is from the fourth entry on down. And I'm actually working on an article to talk about this. And some of the things that I've seen immediately is you got that little box with the graph paper in the back there. And that shows the monster and treasure assortments of the dungeon geomorphs in, because I really didn't know quite where to put them, the NPC sheets and the rogues gallery. And kind of off to the right of that, you can see the adventures starting. Those are the giant adventures in brown, blue, red, and then the descent adventures in brown, green, purple, and then Tomb of Horrors in bloody red at the end. And so that tells you, among other things, how TSR at the start didn't think that people wanted adventures. So you have these 2 years that D&D is out, and all they have are rule books there. That's the three-volume set at the start, and then that's Greyhawk and Blackmoor right under them. And so you can see those first 2 years, they thought, all we need to provide are rules. Because, of course, that's what you had with the wargaming system. It's what you expected. You know, you put out the rules. Yeah, maybe you list scenarios, but I don't know if they actually did at the time or not. And then they said, oh gosh, people want our help in making adventures. And so clearly the way we do that is with randomized tables of monsters. That must be what they want, with randomly generated dungeon maps. I still love the geomorphs. They, you know, they're these full-size 8.5 by 11 sheets that have regularized entrances and exits, and so you can flip them around any way that you want and have pretty much infinite dungeons. So they're a really cool supplement even now. But they are primitive, pragmatic, something like that, when compared to, hey, we do an actual adventure. And so that's the first progression I can see here, from no help for players to we're going to help you in a very do-it-yourself way to we're going to help you with adventures. The second thing that I saw really clearly is, wow, adventures really took over the whole line. And that's even more apparent if you scroll this up, which I know you can't because you just have a screenshot of it. But we go up to 1982 here. That's the bottom line. And if you went down to later to 1984, suddenly the adventures fill that whole right-hand box. You know, they're putting out one rule book a year. 1985, they start putting out two. They're occasionally doing supplements and accessories. Those are the second and third columns. Supplements being, hey, these are more rules that expand on the original but aren't core rule books. And accessories are, hey, these are weird things that we hand out, like character sheets, screens, etc. But these adventures, they just fill everything. And so I think particularly today, when there is such a richness of different types of content, and maybe we saw more of that in maybe the 3E era, especially during D20. The idea that they would put out, you know, maybe 24 products in a year and 22 of them would be adventures, whoa, that's just... And one of the other things that I can see on this chart here is you have this weird thing at the bottom of these four kind of beige products in a weird tall product line at the very bottom of the supplement. And those are their monster card sets, which were these little glossy full color cards, you know, slightly bigger than index card size, that had a picture of a monster on one side and then the stats on the back. And that feels to me, when I look at it, particularly in the whole context of everything done for AD&D, as, you know, maybe the most innovative product they did for this line. It's the only time they tried to do cards. There were other people trying cards, but not this professionally before. And something that can't strike you from this picture, but does if you know the product, is that was the first time almost all of those D&D monsters were ever shown in full color. Unless they were on a cover before, people had never seen a full color picture of them and really got their full context, which is just another reason it was so innovative. And I suspect it was probably a pricey product comparatively with all of that full color glossy printing front and back. So it showed that, hey, 1982, this is kind of just at the verge of their crises starting, because they were kind of in crisis from about 1983 when they started doing layoffs through at least 85, when they were on the verge of going out of business and Gygax got thrown out. But before that, they were like, wow, what can we do that's new and innovative? And, you know, they were doing new and innovative this whole time, but that's the one that strikes me. And I guess now, one last thing that you can see.
Go ahead.
Of the monster cards. Yeah. Yeah. They're cool cards even today. I wish I still had my copies of them. I was just going to say that the last thing that I really note here is the very rapid increase in improvement in product quality production here. You know, you have these digest books at the top left, and then you go a little further down and you have these, you know, frankly, kind of ugly books with plain backgrounds and one color of ink on them. But then suddenly you get the adventures and they figured out, hey, how can we do two colors of ink and actually make them look really nice? And 2 years after that, you have full color pictures. And just past this, you have their product finishing department appearing where they did the well-known orange colored spine things. Jeff Easley redid all of the covers. And so there's another, you know, big leap in production quality and definitely mass market appeal. You know, I love the Arrow Lotus, Sutherland, and Trampier covers from the original editions, but it's still a big change when they decide to move on to something that was going to match the fantasy books that were out on the shelves by that time.
Yeah, nice. To me, the thing that, you know, among the thing that strikes me is original D&D, which is like my go-to. I didn't have it at the time. I discovered it much later in my gaming career. It was only 3 years. We're just that 74, 75, 76 block is that whole era of really incepting the fundamental ideas of the game. That was just 3 years, 36 months. Kind of stunning. In my head, it takes up so much, a much larger part of my headspace. It's really surprising to me to have that laid out in black and white like that. Yeah,
and I think it's probably become maybe bigger than it ever was, thanks to Swords and Wizardry and the fact that, you know, you have lots of people playing OD&D now in various forms, and so many products produced for it when there was almost no products produced for it back in the era.
Yes, good point. So, like I as I was saying, so Paul and I both have a copy of the Monster Cards. And in the past, we've looked at like what gaps they have. They don't have complete comprehensive coverage of the common modules that you would expect. And you know, to me, when I was a kid in the 70s, like obviously you had baseball cards, right? We'd have full color picture of player and then their stats on the back. I myself had, I think, maybe two sets of get ready, everybody, dinosaur cards, where you'd have an illustration of a dinosaur on one side, and then you had a bunch of physical information about the, see, Paul's laughing at me, a bunch of physical information on the dinosaur on the back. And so clearly there was this kind of product in the world that sort of had that shape and size and sensibility there. So I think I've run at least one game where I had some AD&D monster cards that I was showing the players, and also some of my dinosaur flashcards. I think I was running a game of Isle of the Ape, actually. I was like, it's you run into this player. It's interesting that they were looking around at the world of products for good ideas at the time.
Yeah. I had Star Wars trading cards. They came out with stills from the movie on the front, and I don't remember what was on the back, descriptions of scenes or something. And collectible,
right,
of course.
Right.
Oh, and you've got a very bad bubble.
Yes. And this is all pre-magic. So Magic the idea of Magic the Gathering of collectible things you game with hadn't come out yet. That was yet to happen. Okay, I've got to talk about the thing that I don't have the image of it on the other timeline. Something popped out at me at an early era that I have never heard before until your timeline, Shannon. And in the basic timeline, in the adventure category, you have the first basic adventures, B1 In Search of the Unknown, and B2 Keep on the Borderlands, of course. We all know about that. And then the next thing after that is this series of educational adventures that came out right after Keep on the Borderlands. And they did not come out. They weren't. Okay. So yes. I'm seeing two covers, and Paul, they're two brown covers that I've got side by side there. Mm-hmm. These. Okay. Okay. Yeah. So that's you're breaking my heart. You're breaking my heart because I thought somewhere out there, there were these two educational adventures, and there's actually three covers I see there, ED1, 2, and 3. And the first two, somewhat weirdly, have the author's name as Dr. D.C. Snow, and ED1 is a math educational D&D adventure, and number two is a science adventure. I've never heard of, what's the story behind those?
Yeah, so TSR thought they were going to get into the educational business. This is 1981, 82. I'm not quite sure of the year. Yeah, I think they have copyrights of 83, but we think they were done in 82. And so they created an educational department. Maybe Jim Ward, I don't remember. Definitely Rose Estes was in it. I think Gene Black was hired for it. And their idea was, hey, we've already got BX out there. You know, we're bringing the first, what were called at the time, munchkins into it. You know, we talk about munchkins now as, you know, being people that are kind of manipulating the game system. But the original etymology, as far as I've been able to assess, is just, hey, these were the young kids that were coming in, the people in elementary school like me who started playing with the basic sets. And so they said, since we already have this group, why don't we get them, you know, learning things? And so they created this educational department, and they produced three modules. Dr. D.C. Snow was a friend of, again, I think it may have been Jim Ward's. He was playing in one of the local games. He was actually in Illinois, somewhere next to Wisconsin, but he was close enough that he just went over the border to play. Someone had to drive him in, apparently. And, you know, since they had this a professor who was very knowledgeable in, you know, learning, and since they had this, they felt like a group of people, audience that they could sell to, they produce these. And when I say produce, they produce these. There are fully laid out, fully written, fully laid out. You see these covers. These were produced, I would guess, probably at a local print shop. When I worked for Chaosium, we always did a local print of our cover beforehand. And so it wasn't quite the same quality, but hopefully matched the color. And we sent it off with our actual tape that we had the product on so that the printer could match it and make sure we had the same. So I'm sure these were produced at a local print shop like that. Lisa Stevens got me the covers. She apparently had saved them from TSR. She was one of the people at Wizards of the Coast who was brand managing D&D, brand managing Greyhawk. I'm not quite sure what it was right after it came into Wizards of the Coast. And so she had access to these when they showed up, and they're still in her collection. So they were really, really done, just never actually published. But the problem was, as with many things in the era, which was the early 80s, when there was innovation but also access at TSR, they didn't know what the heck they were doing here. And so if they'd actually wanted to put these in classrooms, which was the goal, they would have had to get them approved through school boards. They would have had to make sure that they met certain criteria, which, you know, no one was thinking about when they put them together. And there was no possible way they were going to get approved through school boards when this was right when Mazes and Monsters was coming out. Yeah. You know, the satanic hysteria was moving over to role-playing games, bothered about Dungeons and Dragons, the group was appearing somewhere around here, and so there was increasing bad publicity and how bad it was for kids. And so just no chance, especially not in the Midwest where they were centered. But it was a great idea. And there is also a happy end to this story, which is Rose Estes took a sabbatical at some point from the educational department. And when she was out, she stumbled across in a store somewhere a book called Choose Your Own Adventure. And she was like, wow, this is neat. It's, you know, a novel, but it's a novel where you get to choose your path. What if we did these for Dungeons and Dragons? So she came back, and the staff at TSR were unconvinced. They said, okay, you go ahead and write them yourself, and we'll see what we can do with them. And she did. And they showed them to Random House, their distributor into the book trade. And Random House said, oh my gosh, you have to publish these. And so they put out the first four. They were all by Rose. Return to Brookmere was the first one that was actually published, though it was not the first one she wrote. They sold very well. Those were the Endless Quest books. And as a result, the educational department became the book department a few years later, one or two years later, put out the Dragonlance Chronicles. And suddenly they were making a huge amount of TSR's money. And they were also one of the prime factors in really getting TSR into the general mindscape of America, because, hey, you know, here were these popular post-token books in a world that still did not have many post-token books.
Wow. Crazy. Crazy.
Yeah.
Wow.
So that's the kind of depth that that these books look at. There's, you know, maybe just three or four pages on the educational department. There's some on the Choose Your Own Adventure Endless Quest departments as one of the appendices. And it's the type of thing you can uncover when you're looking at each product individually, especially during this period of these four books where almost everything that was being produced was historic in some way.
Brilliant. Brilliant. I'd never heard any of that bit. That is fascinating.
Yeah, that is that is all very new to me. That's amazing.
Well,
Have you seen physical copies of everything you cover, or are there some things that you've only seen like reproductions of?
Yeah, no, I absolutely have not seen physical copies. Okay. The advantage was, since I was doing this for Drive-Thru RPG, they've supplied me with PDFs of everything I wrote about. And so I could at least go through the physical copies. Obviously, sometimes that gives you kind of a weird, skewed perspective, particularly when you can't see like what was on which cover and how maps were laid out and things like that. So I still have a shelf of AD&D books of my own from when I was growing up. You know, maybe 20% of what I cover in here, maybe 25.
Got it. And I'm also thinking about things like, you know, and we many of us have read this amazing story before, and we don't have time to dig into it. But the original Orange version of B3 Palace of the Silver Princess that actually got almost entirely destroyed, pulped. And the other thing I personally never. Like there are days when I don't feel it. It was actually published, but the you were talking about the dungeon geomorphs, the outdoor geomorphs that Gary made for a city. I've never seen anybody have that, and I've never seen what the insides of that look like. So there are days when I'm not entirely certain it actually got published.
Oh, it did. I've seen a full copy of it. Walled City, it was called. So I have seen a full copy of every single thing in these books, just sometimes not the physical ones.
Amazing. Wow.
Now, I assume with a project of this breadth, right, the problem I'm sure often comes up of like where to draw the line. I'm curious, like, is this very focused specifically on TSR? And this is coming to my head because you mentioned when we were looking at the timeline of TSR taking some time to get their head around the idea that players wanted adventures. Did you ever like branch into the direction of talking about Wii Warriors or any of that stuff, or did you try to like stay on target of just TSR?
Yeah, just barely. The product histories pretty much cover what I wrote about for DriveThruRPG, expanded to, you know, the ones here and there that I didn't get to, like the educational ones that I don't think we even knew about before Jim Ward offered his copies for sale on eBay a few years ago. So there's 320 or so product histories, and they are focused on TSRs, D&D products from 1974 to 1988, plus the basic D&D that came after that all the way to the end of that line. But I got those done, I laid them out, and I said, okay, I still have 10 or 20,000 pages that I could fill in some of the books to make everything come out the same. What else would I like to write about? And so I wrote appendices, which are much briefer. They're not individual product histories. And one of them was the one I just mentioned on the Choose Your Own Adventure, Endless Quest, Super Endless Quest, AD&D game book sequence. And, you know, I talk about kind of all the major beats. Oh, they did these Heart Quest books, which were Romance Endless Quest, Choose Your Own Adventures. Mm-hmm. They did these mm-hmm. Crimson Cavern, I think they were called, little ruby things that you read through, and they showed things that just were a red blur without them. Kind of, they never worked very well. And I also have a set of, I think it's 5 appendices on everyone who did semi-official D&D products in this era. So that's Judges Guild, Wii Warrior, Games Workshop, Chaosium, maybe it's just the 4? But all of the people who did semi-official products, and those are all official by different ways. Judges Guild was licensed. Wii Warriors was distributed by D&D, which is not quite a license, but it's the closest thing because they're saying, yes, this is okay. Games Workshop mostly did distribution, but they put out a couple of D&D-branded things like some character sheets. And Chaosium put out Thieves' World, which had the official okay of D&D as an exchange for the Melniboni and Cthulhu myths, which were in Deities and Demigods, even though Chaosium had the license for them. Though, of course, TSR pulled those almost immediately after, but they had a license to use them even after they pulled them. They just didn't want to give attention to Chaosium is how the story goes.
Nice. Our friend Sparrow is in the chat is also asking about Rolaids, and I think you do have an appendix about Mayfair in there, right?
Yeah, that's the 5th one, Mayfair. Thank you.
Nice. Brilliant. Fantastic. Okay, so 1,400 plus pages, and it's all written. So I think in order to actually get this to the people, you and Evil Hat Productions are going to be crowdfunding it starting this week. Am I right about that?
Yeah, so we have a backer kit page where they're already up to preview. You can sign up to be notified when it goes live. I think we looked it up, and it is going live in about 45 hours now from it. Not quite sure how many weeks it's going to run, but it should be running for a few weeks. The main product is going to be a slipcase of the 4 hardcover books, beautifully produced, full color, as you can see. I'm enthused to see what they look like. But we are also offering PDFs, ebooks, pods, and I think most exciting for a lot of people, audiobooks narrated by Colby Elviott, who did such a great job on the original Designers and Dragons audiobooks. And so all of those are going to be available. The print books are only available from the crowdfunding domestically in the United States, but we'll have them distributed to stores across the world as soon as they are printed as well. And that's going to be a cheaper way for people in the rest of the world to get them anyways than trying to ship them out of the US, especially right now.
Fantastic. So we have a link to the backer kit for Origins in our YouTube description, so people can check that out. And that will be starting 2 days from this live show. So that's October 21st. Is when that starts. So you can mark that on your calendars and get on the backer kit for Origins as soon as possible, because I've never seen a project of this magnitude about the early history of D&D that we all adore so much. So we are really looking forward to that on Tuesday in 2 days.
Yeah, I think it's worth noting that there's been some excellent histories of early TSR. John Peterson and Ben Riggs have both done great histories. John Peterson's done business history, and he's also done design history, and Ben Riggs is more focused on business history. Playing at the World by John, Game Wizards by John, and Slaying the Dragon by Ben. They're all well recommended, and I'm not trying to cover the same thing they're doing. This is very different in that we're looking at each product, saying what's the history behind this product, sometimes going out and talking about the larger history, like, you know, this was Dave Arneson's last thing. He left the company after this, you know, for these reasons. He was unhappy with its commercialism, etc. Also, we talk about lots of the other things that a particular product may focus on. So we might talk about the tropes of an adventure. We might talk about the NPCs that appeared for the first time. We might talk about the way rules have changed. And so just wanted to say there's lots of other great history. That's how these are very different. They're product histories.
Agreed. We love John. We've had him talk about playing on the World a number of times here on the show, so also highly recommended. And to me, you know, what you're doing with Origins still seems fresh to my eyes. So I'm continually learning more about it as I see that, and really appreciate that you're making this available.
Yeah, it was great to put it together. It's been many years coming. I wrote the original histories for DriveThruRPG back starting in 2015. And starting in 2020, I've been spending about a year a book to get them revised, edited, expanded, sometimes filled in for ones that I hadn't written at all. And so it's been a product of many, many years of work and love. And so I'm really enthused to share what it looks like. It's these comprehensive, you know, books that actually tell a full story through, hopefully.
Brilliant. Brilliant. And we have a link to the back of the kit in the chat right now. Thanks, Paul.
Yes, we do.
Yeah,
I can say it like that.
Go ahead. Yeah, we've had 2,700 people sign up so far. So I'm very happy that we have a lot of people enthusiastic about it.
Yeah, I think the focus on specific products is just very exciting for me personally. Like, I know there's some kind of odd things in my own collection even that I have that I bought. Like, in the early 90s, I ended up with a lot of like the Dragon Quest and First Quest boxes when basically I think right around maybe a year or two after they came out, KB Toy Stores was going out of business and they were just selling this stuff for like a dollar or two a pop, and I just hoarded it. And I've always been curious, like, what's the story behind these products? Like, I barely remember them. They're sitting in a box in my attic. I would love to know more. So I'm really excited to dig into that.
Yeah, and I know Dragon Quest is in book 4 because it goes out to some of the weird boxes they put out at the time. I think First Quest is too. And they were interesting to see. And I always found it really weird that this was this time period in the mid 90s that you could really see how much TSR was already starting to flail, because pretty much every year starting in 1991, they had a new introductory box out. And so we see the first several of those in book 4 of this.
Yeah, totally agree with that. Yeah, First Quest is in there. Yep.
Yeah, I noticed. Yeah, I think you had mentioned a couple times the black box, right? That's the big landscape board game box of basic D&D. Also, mm-hmm. I didn't realize that was such a big seller, but of course I've got one sitting on my shelf. I always thought it was actually possibly one of their better attempts at introducing total newbies to the concept.
Yeah, I thought it was a great little set, especially for its time period, which was 1991, same year as the Rules Cyclopedia came out, because it had these full maps of each dungeon, you know, years and years before dungeon tiles or anything, but they were these gorgeous full color, and the only thing was that they were set, they weren't geomorphic. They had little stand-up figures for all of the characters. Yep. And so they really presented it as Dungeons & Dragons as a board game, but it was the full basic D&D rules, which wasn't the case for some of the later ones like Dragon Quest and Dragon Strike, which were, you know, really cut down or not even D&D in some of the cases. And it went up to fifth level, so it actually went beyond the standard scope of basic D&D. They put it out with additional black box supplements, which had more maps and were produced in the same gorgeous style. But it was also what led to the Thunder Rift series, which kind of offered a little micro setting of a valley, the Thunder Rift, which is pretty well loved today still. So, you know, we were talking about the innovation of the D&D line, and that was basic D&D line, and that was part of it right at the very end.
Yeah, that's great
nice.
Stuff. I'm very much looking forward to reading all about that.
Totally. And I'll say, it's an interesting year or two right around there. So, right, and Paul, I'm going to cover up your face. I apologize. So, right at the start of the show, our friend Bart Shea got on the chat. And the very first thing he said was Dungeons & Dragons Rule Cyclopedia by Aaron Alston is pure perfection. And you know what? That's a strong argument. When that came out at the time, I picked it up. It's a gorgeous book. It has all the Beckme stuff all compiled together except for the Immortals. And there was a year I was like, this is all I need. This is all I'm going to play for D&D for the foreseeable future is just Rule Cyclopedia. And that was, yeah. They were in that basic line. They were really doing some really interesting creative stuff.
One of my problems I have as a history writer is that I see or I'm reminded of these great things. I'm like, oh my God, I have to go get a copy of it. And so when I was writing, you know, the World Cyclopedia content a couple of years ago, I was like, oh, I have to go get a copy. But you know, it's, I don't know, $100, $200, somewhere in that range in eBay. And I could never quite bring myself to get it. I didn't really want the copy through DriveThruRPG as pod because it's just got all the maps bound in, which is kind of messy. So I eventually settled on Old School Essentials instead, which isn't quite the same thing because it's only BNX, not the whole BCMI. But it satisfied my, I really want a copy of a basic rule system that I can use if I want to.
Nice. Nice. Rule Cyclopedia is apparently one of my better purchases at the time when I got it when it first came out.
Yeah, it was unfortunately when I was on to Ars Magica and things in college.
Yeah. We are just about out of time, Shannon. Is there anything else about the books that you wanted to get out there to our viewers before we wrap up?
The only other thing I'd probably say is we're going to have a preview on the backers kit, the same press kit that you've seen. It may be there right now. I'm not quite sure, but I think it's going to be available when people actually start backing. And we're going to expand it into something called the Adventurer's Horde. Right now it's got 57, 60 pages, somewhere in that range. But we're going to let people vote and say, hey, what things would we like to see? And so we're going to expand that PDF so that backers can have a ever-increasing view of what's in the books while we're doing the final work, proofreading it and printing it for release next year.
Brilliant.
Viewers, if you have any comments, things, more details you would like to see about the sets, or if you want to find out where you can sign up for the emails so that you can be notified when this thing goes live in just 2 days, visit the comment section of our YouTube description here. You'll find the link there, and let us know what you think. Let us know what you're looking forward to. We'd love to hear from you.
Definitely, and of course, remember that you can like, follow, and subscribe to us. We're on YouTube and Twitch. Facebook, TikTok, Loops, we're on GitHub. We have the handle Wandering DMs on all those sites, so please look for us there and canonize that like button.
If you prefer to watch this or listen to this show in audio-only podcast format, you can do so. Those files are available on our site at wanderingdms.com. Also through various podcast carriers like iTunes, Spotify, Pocket Cast. If you're listening to the show right now on one of those other sites and it offers the ability to do so, please rate and review our show. That helps other users of that site find us, and we really appreciate it.
We really do. And of course, big thanks to our patrons who support the show here. If you'd like to join them, please visit patreon.com/wanderingdms. You go there, you'll see every tier gets you access to a private Discord server where the conversation continues 24/7 about all the games we love. Original D&D, advanced, new school D&D, basic BX, wargaming, horror games, all this kind of stuff. We just have the best, wisest patrons with just awesome creative ideas. Just this past weekend, my mind has been blown by some of the creative ideas that folks have come up with on our Discord server. And we will be there in about 10 minutes for the live video after chat with me and Paul with viewers, get some more of your thoughts about these classic editions and what Shannon has done in order to document some stuff that none of us knew until he tells us about it, frankly. So Shannon, thank you so much for joining us today. Hope people get on that backer kit on October 21st. And I hope this is a smashing success because it deserves to be.
Thank you. Appreciate being here. Thanks for having me on.
Fantastic. Hopefully we can get you on some other time. And for now, don't forget, viewers, we are live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern time. So please join us again next week for another thought-provoking discussion.
We'll see you then.